Is your team not performing well? Is morale low and turnover high? Are you falling further behind the competition? I'm here to help. I'm your host, Shani, and this is the Leadership Show, where business strategy and culture finally meet, and we make the long-awaited shift from rhetoric to results. I promise I'm not your typical boring leadership consultant, and I will help you get your shift together. Let's do this. Hello, Leadershifters, and welcome to another edition of the Leadershifter Show with Shady. Today's guest is LaMarcus Miller, and I am just going to start off by being totally irreverent and saying he is cool as fuck, okay? You guys are going to love LaMarcus's story. So from his roots as an opera singer to his journey through corporate America, doing various things, including corporate communications and working in sports, and then shifting again into academia and doing his PhD at University of Southern California and teaching, and now his current incarnation, where he is combining all of that great experience and creating a new niche in the music industry that we cannot wait to tell you all about. So LaMarcus, welcome from Los Angeles, of course, to the Leadership Show.
Shani, thank you so much. You made me sound way cooler than I thought I was.
Oh no, you're cool.
I'm so sad. It is such a gloomy, this is the gloomiest LA day that has ever happened. And you know, there's only like 3 gloomy days in LA a year.
Right.
Be the second one.
Oh, well, that's too bad. Well, you know what? That's okay, because we are bringing sunshine to the podcast world today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So let's start off by just quickly walking our listeners through your journey. I mean, I went boom, 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 boom. Start from the beginning and bring us up to today, where we can start to talk about all the fascinating things that you're doing in the music biz.
Absolutely. So my journey started in high school. I was all geared up to go to the military. I was in JROTC. I went to leadership camp and, you know, ran through the woods and camping and all these things and shooting. And my senior year of high school, I heard a recording of some opera arias, and I heard Maria Callas and Pavarotti and Ferruccio Furlanetto. And something inside of me said, you're supposed to make these sounds. I had never sung. I had never had any interest in singing, but this completely changed 4 years of strategizing. So I was so overwhelmed. I decided, and this was my first experience with shifting.
From ROTC military guy to opera singing. Like, I can't think of two more disparate paths.
Agreed. Well, you and my family, they're like, WTF, what is happening?
So right, that's when the hashtag was made. Even before hashtags existed.
Exactly.
Your family was like, WTF.
WTF, hashtag WTF. Because this was like early 2000s. So like 2006. So yes, I made the shift. First thing I started was, you know, how do I make this transition? Because there was a big learning curve. You know, classical singing is slightly different from contemporary pop singing, and that the need for the sound is pre-amplification. So the way in which one wields their voice is extremely important, to do it in a very safe way, but in a way that one voice can be heard over 60 plus instruments. So there was that learning curve of just vocal technique, how to sing. And then, you know, most operas aren't in English. A lot more are being written in English with this new boom of contemporary opera. But specifically, you know, how do I get a governance of German, Russian, Czech, Italian, French? You know, all of this was very, very foreign. So I was up for a ton of work. So I started off at Texas A&M Commerce, transferred to Dallas Baptist University, finished my undergrad there, had a pretty good technique at that point. So I decided to move to New York, to the Manhattan School of Music, where I really, you know, stepped into my own And, you know, there really started getting traction. I won the Nico Castile Master Singer Competition of the World at Carnegie Hall in about 2012. That debuted, made my debut in at Carnegie Hall with that competition. Ended up winning the, what is like an encouragement award from the Metropolitan Opera Competition.
Eventually, kids have been training their whole lives for this, and you just like rock up at like 20 and decide to be an opera singer and kill it. Just a few years.
Yeah. I mean, I was tremendously lucky, and I was a tremendous hard worker because I knew there was a big learning curve. So I spent my undergrad, you know, it took me 5 years to finish the undergrad learning, you know, how to be a musician, first of all. And then, of course, I would say my biggest claim to fame in the opera world, an opportunity came to me via the Kennedy Center. It was a new opera that had been being written in Canada. And I can't remember, he's a part of the Annenberg family, but he owns Explore.org.
Okay.
And he funded this project about Fallujah, the 2004 Iraq War.
Oh.
And I sang, well, at that point I didn't have the role. They just sent me, you know, a piece of what they were writing, the composer did. And they said, record this and send it back. So I recorded it, sent it back. So this starts me on this journey of the story of PTSD and moral injury of this Marine vet who had gone to Fallujah, or, you know, and this wasn't just his story. It was really iconic for anyone who was dealing with PTSD.
Sure.
So it was a real education for society and myself. And I got to sing that at first the Kennedy Center for their World Stages, you know, festival. And then from there, TED Med, I sang an aria or two for their, you know, medical version of TED Talk.
Uh-huh.
And Long Beach Opera produced it. So they built the production from scratch. And it was a completely digital production. We did a documentary, which won an Emmy. And Fallujah became an opera movie. Then New York City Opera bought the production and I went with it. And I think they mounted it off Broadway in some off Broadway theater. And all this time I'm working, you know, at that time I was working at Weber Shandwick in internal communications. So I was, you know, internal comms during the day, opera singer at night.
Right. You're like Superman.
Yeah. I was kind of all over the place. So I was doing that. USC made me a really great offer around 2017 to come. And specifically, you know, I was really interested in leveraging the classical vocal technique to pop singers. Because many pop singers, they just weren't lasting longer. They were having lots of vocal issues. And I'm like, there's something that can be leveraged from the bel canto style of singing because it's preamplification. We're having to do this, you know, 3 hours at a time nightly or over the course of a month, you know, spread out, of course. And there's a lot that can be leveraged from this bel canto style of singing into the commercial pop music industry. So that was really a big interest to me. And I taught for 3 years at USC. You know, pandemic hits, I go into social justice. I just sort of fell into the role and I really got to get into the nitty gritty, the importance of strategic partnerships with corporate brands and re-educating society on the narrative of not just Black lives, but alternative of minorities.
Sure.
And partnering to fund workforce development initiatives that would then tee up, you know, opportunities. Because, you know, the whole goal is sort of sanitizing these neoliberalistic constructs.
Right.
And, you know, while I'm doing that, I'm still kind of, you know, underwater, you know, trying to thread together, okay, how can I somehow find the thread of continuity from the classical music industry and the pop music industry and where that sits comfortably.
I love that, the thread of continuity. Because, you know, just on the surface, if you were to just serve people up the little tidbits of experience that you had, most people would look at that and go, I don't know what the hell to do with this, right? It's so different, you know, like it's so different and random and seemingly unrelated,
yep.
Yet you did find a thread of continuity. And that's one of the reasons I was so excited to have you on the show, was just as a role model for people who are doubting their own experiences. I have lots of clients and even friends who are like, oh, you know, I've done this and I've done that, and I don't know if I'm qualified to do anything else. And, you know, people want to hire folks in XYZ industry that have, you know, a certain cookie cutter resume. And I'm here to say, maybe some do, but yep, not everywhere. And maybe it's also an opportunity to create your own destiny and be the one who's innovative enough to see the value in all these seemingly dichotomous experiences. So bravo for you cobbling that together and seeing the thread.
No, that's amazing. And I think you've touched on such an important issue with the job market. And, you know, what are we actually looking for? And, you know, especially now, I think I'm hoping the tide is turning and how companies are acquisitioning talent and how we're thinking about contribution and value proposition, as opposed to those cookie cutter, like, you know, you need to have been in internal comms for 15 years for us to even consider you for, you know, I think by finding those parallelisms, because I think that's going to play out in how we deal with clients. You know, I always look at, I'm really, my diverse background really tees up my ability to speak to and find those, you know, parallelisms between potential strategic partners, between potential clients, talking differently, switching and chameleonizing my jargon to make people feel comfortable, because I consider myself a relationship strategist.
Okay.
And, you know, having a very, you know, corporate tied up, you know, jargon and presentation, while that's helpful and definitely in the right context works, might not work so much in certain arenas. So just understanding everyone's unique experiences and being empathetic.
Right, right. So for example, you know, the jargon I used at the beginning of the call or the podcast, saying that you were cool as fuck, right? That goes, people don't blink an eye in the music industry. In corporate America, where I tend to dabble, it raises eyebrows, but it's not that I don't care. It's just like, whatever, like,
yeah.
It's like, get over it.
Yeah. So yeah, that's, I'm really proud now of my very diverse background. And what I've discovered is, hold on, something's coming to me. You will find your tribe and your tribe will find you. And there will be a love affair between you both when and if when that comes. Mm-hmm. I think if people don't see your value, that's not something, it's kind of like love. It's not my job to convince you, you know. If you see it, then that's great. If you don't, then that just means that's not, you're not part of my tribe.
Yep.
And that's okay.
Yep, absolutely. And the way people can communicate in this day and age, it's easier to find the tribe than ever, regardless of where they are in the world.
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to just be your tribe as seen through the local newspaper the way it used to be. Yeah. So let's, you know, you mentioned that you had gotten into the social justice space and, you know, pre-show you and I talked about just a crazy, deplorable experience that you had. And one of the things related to social justice and DEI that has been a thread through a lot of my podcasts over the past couple of years is, like, let's not be afraid to talk about the subject, and let's let people have the opportunity to share their stories, as hard as it is to share them and as hard as it is to hear them, because we're not going to make progress unless people can truly understand what it's like to be in other people's shoes, whether it's people of color or otherness, right? You know, like, you'll never know what it's like to be a Jewish woman, and I will never know exactly what it's like to be, you know, a Black man. But we don't have to. We just need to share the stories. So with that way too wordy preamble to the question, would you share with us the experience that you had over 7 years?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think in the context of us speaking about that, I really wanted to surface this narrative that racism happens to anyone, any Black or Asian or, you know, any alternative person, minority person, regardless of where they are in their career or how you perceive them, you know, for whatever reason, my skin has been villainized and it is seen as you know, dangerous. And there's a whole narrative in history that has, so being a Black person, you innately adopt this history. And it behooves us to fully learn the full breadth and scope of it so that then we can navigate the world knowing that this skin comes with baggage.
Right, right. And that baggage is over hundreds, if not thousands of years, yep. You know, depending on how far back you go. And I mean, I know I'm appreciating that more than ever in some of the reading and research that I've been doing. And so yes, thank you for setting that context.
Yeah. So, you know, it was very random. It was my sophomore year of college. I get a call from my aunt and she says, there's a warrant out for your arrest. That was how the conversation starts. And I am in, you know, Commerce, Texas. She's in Houston, Texas. And the incident occurred in Huntsville, Texas. And I had never been to Huntsville. Fast forward, we discovered someone had done some sort of clerical error and mixed up my social or birth date with someone else. And I get a warrant out for my arrest. And I have to then do the due diligence in trying to track down where the disconnect was, but at the same time, trying to keep my distance because there's a warrant, so they can take me. So all I'm thinking is the minute I'm in custody, the narrative is going to completely shift. And who knows what happened to me. So I need to figure this out. So thank God for law and order. You know, so I call the prosecutor and, you know, ask him, you know, you're prosecuting the wrong person. And she asked me, what's your name? I tell her my name. She goes, what's your birth date? I tell her my birth date. She says, what's your social? It's like, well, what social do you have? And I'll tell you for the right one. She's like, I'll get back to you. Never hear from her again. I ended up meeting a judge who, I think, you know, he's like, I'll work on this. It seems like there's some dimension of clerical error. And I'll never forget the cop. His name was Sergeant Flowers. And he helped he was very, very helpful in trying to get this fixed. Now, this was year one. Year two, three, four, five, I get a warrant every year because this guy wasn't showing up because they had the wrong person. Years, I thought I fixed it year five. Year seven, it arises again. There's another warrant. By this time, I'm in New York working in real estate. We didn't talk about that. I worked for Trump Realty for a minute.
Oh boy.
way before he was even considering president. Just tidbit off that, I was working with this amazing woman named Susan James. She wore black Chanel suits every day. And she told me, I remember her telling me, you need to follow your dreams, LaMarcus. And she just a wonderful woman. And I hope, you know, maybe this podcast will reach her. But Susan, thank you so much for those kind words. 2014, I get another call. And so then I call the court's office, you know, trying to figure out why is this still happening. It's, you know, first time this happened, I think it was in 2006, 2007. And I get on the phone with someone and the woman tells me, it doesn't matter who we catch. You are all murderers and thieves. And we will catch one of you, and hangs up in my face.
Unbelievable.
So I'm calling the office multiple times because I'm in such shock because, you know, I'm trying to move on and live my life and this thing is hanging over me. So long story short, we ended up getting that fixed. And she was not happy about it because I ended up calling her boss. And it was so funny. She ended up having to write the sort of letter for me to have with me, you know, as I'm moving and driving around, you know, because I don't know if, you know, if not on my record. But, you know, that was the journey of that. It was a matter of sort of for 7 years navigating life, like, oh gosh, you know, what if this is on my record because it's, you know, or what if they find me and it's not actually me? And then this horrible thing happens simply because of a clerical error. And, you know, thank God I was, you know, diligent enough to sort of ask questions and try to, you know, vet what's happening because under the wrong circumstances, or had I been in Houston at that time, the story could have completely flipped.
Right.
So that was my most egregious experience with racism. I'm very lucky that I haven't experienced anything else, but I'm very young and there's still a lot of life to live. How old was George Floyd? Like, you know, much older than me. So, you know, I would just preface all of that, and you know, as I'm knitting that up, I would just say that it is a cognizant, we are all very cognizant of it happening to any of us. It's not a matter of if, but when.
Right.
So, you know, as I'm going throughout the day, I'm constantly, you know, aware of my surroundings. And, you know, I'm actually, I remember my grandmother before, you know, when we were children, you have the sex talk. I had the race talk before the sex talk. And that race talk was my grandmother telling me, you have three strikes against you. You're Black, you're male, and you live in America. She's like, you must be constantly aware of your surroundings, where you are, who you're hanging out with, because you cannot do everything that everyone else does. And at that point in my life, we're talking elementary, we're talking 90s, you know, getting this kind of, this gravitas, this this heavy information.
Right.
That has played, that has really revealed itself in so many different nuances in my life thus far. So, yeah, I mean, I just think, you know, as minorities, we're just tremendously cautious. And I think just having empathy and understanding that we have that we have history and baggage, that there's a worldview of Black skin that we're trying to shift.
Yeah. Well, and so what would you recommend to people who really are allies and want to help? Like, what's something that people can do regularly, and or like what's impactful? Because it's the empathy is certainly the first step. Action has to follow that. So what do you recommend?
You know what? And I'm gonna be very, very, I'm gonna step on a lot of toes here. And you know,
step away. You're on the Leadershifter show.
I was talking to Carolyn, actually. We were talking about DEI, and I've always thought it was very funny that we asked minorities what to do about racism when we didn't create it.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, I feel like anything that I might offer is always going to be sort of fixing the peripheral damage. You know, at the core of what needs to happen, because we can make policy all day, we can talk about, yes, okay, the cliches, yes, we need opportunity, we need equity, we need that the access to capital to actually be able to play in the game, you know.
Right, and earlier in life, and better education, yeah,
I mean, all of it. Things, but to me, I consider that very peripheral. Like, what we need is a shifting of the worldview of how we view Black people. Like, once I change and shift that worldview, then the rest of the things are gonna, to me, I think it's just gonna make sense. But if I already see you as less than, then of course, all of the rest of the things are not going to transpire, because I see you as a minority as not worthy of those other peripheral advantages. But if I'm able to shift my worldview as, you know, you are an equal brother or sister, or you are someone who is on par with me or a colleague, then those things come natural in a lot of ways. So for me, I think it's a real re-education of the world, because we're not just talking society. We're talking for years that America has villainized Black skin and to the entire world. So now every country, every race has an experience with Black people, a narrative about Black people that we've had no control over.
Right.
So re-educating the world on who Black people are, and not using, you know, one-offs to judge the entire race.
Oh, absolutely. Great. Okay. Well, thank you for the dialogue. I just think it's incumbent upon everybody to just listen no more. And that's one of the ways that perception is going to shift.
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's move, because I'm super interested to hear your newest venture is called Pusher Music, yes?
Well, it's Pusher is one of the sister companies.
Okay.
The Ground Running is the licensing part of the company, but I've just started in music licensing. I quit my job last week. No, Monday of this week.
Oh.
So I'm in the big shift right now. I just quit my job Monday, and that was a lot because, we're in the midst of a pandemic. I'm giving up a great salary, I'm giving up benefits, and to
Yes.
shift into this new career, humbling my soul to learn something new. And, I'm still processing that, which is why I was so excited to come on the show because I am in the minutia of the shift.
Yeah. Right. And how does that feel?
You know what? I woke up one day and, well, it started when I was when I heard this devotional about waiting and how in life we are constantly in a state of waiting. We are either waiting for something to end or waiting for something to begin. And what are we doing with that time while we're waiting? And she started using a lot of W words. She was like, are we growing weary? We're weary while we're waiting. Are we wasteful while we're waiting? Are we worried while we're waiting? And her whole thing, and what I got from this, what I was able to surmise was that it was about learning how to wait well. And and I was thinking, how horrible would that be if while we're waiting for this thing to end or waiting for this new thing to begin, that we are wasting all of this time in the interim. Can we be happy while we're waiting? Absolutely. Can we be joyful and enjoy life's treasures and enjoy the positive things and enjoy the sun and enjoy the beach while we're waiting? Absolutely. So for me, it was learning how to wait well and that this was not going to happen quick. There is no elevator to success. Take the stairs. I really had to drive that in and learn to wait well. I just want to keep saying that. Wait well. Because
I
even
love
when
it. It's because it's realistic. People say, oh no, focus on the positive. If you'll only be successful if you dream of success. And yes, but it takes hard work, right? And so I like the idea of waiting well, that and you've got the vision. You've also got the patience that
Yes.
it's not going to happen overnight because those expectations will kill you.
Absolutely. And what I think I do really well, and this is the thread of continuity, is the ability to industries and humble my soul and heart to learn something new. I'm a doctorate. I have a doctorate. Most people would say you should be doing this or you should be doing that. But I'm starting at the very low end of the totem pole with a doctorate. With all of this experience, I've done 3 degrees in music. I've had a massive opera career. I've worked in, sports and media distribution and academia and social justice. And I am humbling my soul because to me, doctorate means forever learner. It doesn't mean as someone who's elevated above others. It means
Right.
forever learner.
Oh, so great.
So, this opportunity is absolutely no different than my last couple of opportunities because they've been so different. It means I'm an empathetic worker, I'm an empathetic person, I love people, and I understand the value in learning and listening to people. And that's how I'm viewing this opportunity. While I am nervous because I've let go of a salary, I'm a believer in God. And 2006, God told me that he was going to take the most ambiguous field there is and prove to me that he would take care of me. And he has. I had never sung, and opera has literally moved me all around the world, given me opportunities, brought me to USC. It's just teed up a lot of things. Just yesterday, I got a call from Opera Santa Barbara about singing Das Rheingold in one of their productions in June. And then
Wow.
I'm thinking, most people are like, oh, that's not, you don't do that anymore. And it's like, why can't I? Can I be more than one thing? Can I be a
Course.
music supervisor? Can I be an executive that's tremendously knowledgeable and an awesome opera singer that just happens to sing, German opera by Wagner for a month? So
Yes.
still my agent is figuring that out if that's going to be a possibility or not. I'm still figuring that out if, how to engage with that world. But I think as I'm stepping into my new line of work, and music licensing, The reason being for music, so I just want to break down music licensing. For those who don't know, music licensing is the licensing of music to television, to some sort of visual. So I love it because there's a really big A&R artist advocacy piece. And it's different from A&R from, say, record labels. You know, A&R record labels are really looking to vet and surface talent that is activating, you know, certain engagement in certain territories. They're looking at, you know, who's the new hot thing, you know, how do we leverage it? Essentially, now there's definitely an artist development piece, but I would say that's a pretty big leader as far as who they're going to acquisition to the label because it's an investment, right?
Sure.
Now, on the music licensing side, it does not discriminate against genre. It does not. So you could be, you know, I don't know, a kazoo quartet.
Peruvian flute band.
Peruvian, exactly. And as long as it serves the scene, as long as it serves the project, then it is perfect. Then it is king in that moment. So for me, that really like sparked something in me that this is an opportunity for me to really serve artists and for me to find ways in which for them to help tell stories, for their work to be surfaced, and for them to, you know, it's very low risk. We're not asking to like, you know, we want your whole catalog and, you know, we want to pay you out. You know, it's if you have 4 or 5 songs, or if, you know, if this one song works perfectly and serves this scene in this movie or this TV or show or this doc, then this is an opportunity that's going to get you visibility. This is an opportunity that's going to, you know, boost your career. And I just love that piece, especially for unsigned artists who are just looking for an opportunity. So that really spoke to me.
Right. I don't know why this particular band and situation comes to mind, but I used to watch Grey's Anatomy. I haven't watched it in years, but I watched it back at the beginning. And the song by The Fray, How to Save a Life, which was on when Katherine Heigl's character was involved with a guy named Denny who was dying. And The Fray song, How to Save a Life, was during one of those scenes, and it catapulted The Fray into massive fame. And what I make up about that is, you know, that somebody licensed that as some unknown band and suddenly they weren't unknown anymore.
I'm so glad you have that story, Shani. That's exactly what I want to do, is I really want to build that connection to artists and not just the commercial pop music world, but also the classical music industry. The classical music industry is going through a tough time right now because so much of what they do is live. And when we think about the peripheral effects of COVID-19, singing is one of the deadliest ways in which to spread the virus, because of, and especially with opera, because the consistent thrust of breath. And as you know, breath, like, I don't want to get into vocology, but when you take a breath, you know, here we go, we have a voice lesson. You take a breath, air comes out of the lungs, goes across the vocal folds, and we need a consistent vibration that is then sent into the vocal tract, which starts at the larynx, ends at the lips, and is then resonated here and then emitted. So singers need a lot of that resonance, because remember, it's preamplification. So we're using in many ways a lot more consistent breath than most pop singers because they have the microphone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this style of singing is even more dangerous, and so to speak. So I always say COVID-19 is to the classical singer as the disruptive technologies of 1999 and 2000 with Napster and those pirating were to the commercial pop music industry.
Oh, interesting.
And that I think is going to completely shift how the classical music world engages with society and audiences and needing to, you know, really push things and digital engagement. And I just think they're gonna have to shift things. And I think they're going to, I'm hoping to be that helping hand or that olive branch that sits on the commercial pop music industry side, but fully understands all the nooks and crannies of the nonprofit arts music making world and finding that connective tissue.
Oh, I love that. So giving visibility to musicians and composers. So it's not even just the singers, right? It's the composers as well and the whole value chain, if you will.
I would say everyone, composers who are, you know, writing operas, writing symphonies, writing, you know, string quartets or, you know, wind ensembles, you know, adapting that to, you know, learning a digital audio workstation. So they're probably using Finale or I forgot what the other ones, but I like Finale, and, you know, actually using notes and things, you know, they're not necessarily doing that as much in the pop music industry. We're sending stems. So, you know, teaching them how to use a DAW and how to migrate all those really great ideas into a more digital format so that they are then acquisitioning this new stream of revenue.
Right. Okay. And so what's your plan? Literally you're just making this shift. Like how can those who are listening help you or honor you or spread the word?
Wow. That's a very good question. follow me on LinkedIn, connect with me on LinkedIn. My power is that I don't know everything. And as you know, I'm a forever learner, and I'm always looking for ways in which to learn and to help. And, you know, so I would say connect with me, share things that I do not know, ways in which you might think that I can contribute, please reach out to me to help. Giving me a platform in which that I can share this, because I think it's a matter of right now I'm in a learning phase again, so I'm having to go back and learn again. I'm learning this new world of music licensing because they gave me an opportunity, because they are my tribe, because they saw the thread of continuity and said, you know what, I see the parallelisms to how he could do this. And I'm applying that and learning and taking my time. But whilst I'm doing that, my goal, I actually plan on starting a YouTube series called, you know, I'm still working on the name, but it's like Dr. L, the opera singing, you know, music licensing person or whatever. He's a licensing guy, and talking about the music business and talking about licensing and hopefully really creating a world in which I can authentically and organically engage with new artists and surface their music and have that conversation when I'm at the table with networks and saying, you know what, if there is room, I'd really like, you know, this, I'm really passionate about artist advocacy. I'd love to surface at least 3 or 4 bands in an episode that are unknown.
Right. Oh, that's so awesome. I mean, is that really the future of the music business, given all the shifts that have taken place away from the traditional just labels and, you know, no more CDs? It's all just streaming and downloads.
You know, it's interesting. In 2017, I believe, was the first big upswing where we saw more, more streaming than mechanical sales, right? So the business model has certainly shifted from sales to now access with digital. So I certainly do not. Now, the big question in the industry is streaming the savior of the music industry? Because, you know, the industry was still hurting from 1999 and 2000. They were having to re-educate the society on the value of music. So I know, and it's like 2017, now we're in a big, 2018, we had the Music Modernization Act, which I won't go too deeply into that. That's a whole other thing, but it was essentially a big upgrade in understanding this new digital world. And I think certainly the digitization of music is not going anywhere. I think that is going to be a new thing. I think as far as artists are concerned, because now the big question is, you know, independent or label. I personally see the value for both. You know, it's kind of like you. It's like, do you need to be with a big company to be happy and to be effective? Absolutely not. Doesn't take anything away from those companies, but doesn't take anything away from you either.
Right.
I think the same thing applies for artists. If it works for you and if it works for your brand and for your, you know, worldview to be independent, and there's a whole slew of, you know, bullet points that, you know, needs to be crossed off that makes that for that to make sense, then that's great. But then I also see the relevance of a label. You know, a label has a lot of access and they have a lot of reach. You have teams that are dedicated to music synchronization, teams that are dedicated to marketing, teams that are dedicated to, you know, partnerships, you know, and that's very attractive. And then, you know, upfront pay to pay for your album and finding the right producers, like that's a very, very attractive thing. So,
and one can precede the other. I mean, like, yeah. I'm not a, what do you call the people who are crazy about, I'm not a believer or for Justin Bieber, but right. He started just playing on YouTube, as I recall, and became a sensation and then got signed by a label. And now, like, you can't turn on the radio without hearing one of his songs.
This is what I think. This is my total own opinion, is I think what's happened now, and this kind of happened, you know, I feel like it's happening more so now, but record labels are using streaming service as a kind of ATS system. You know what I mean? They're kind of using them. Okay, so what is your own personal brand and band, or, you know, act? What are you bringing? Like, what are your numbers? Where have you performed? Like, you know, what territories are you activating before they acquisition? So there's a lot of, now artists are going to have to do a lot more legwork because there is so much more available. They have, you know, at the click of a button, they have distribution. They have, you know, Spotify, they have Pandora, you know, they can book their own gigs, they can do their own marketing. They have, you know, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all these platforms in which to have a very Herculean reach that labels, I think, are very much so looking at, and they're seeing, you know, is this a good investment? So I kind of think it's like working like a kind of applicant tracking system, you know, like seeing, you know, do you have the right buzzwords, do you have the right numbers, and then we'll like bring for an interview.
It lowers the risk if the label sees that the artist has generated some buzz on social media and online, lowers the risk of signing them.
And, you know, that's why I think A&R has gotten so much more analytics based. I'm hoping that it will get more artist development focused, which is what I'm interested in, even down to vocology, you know, the science of singing. You know, singers use their voices. They use, you know, their vocal folds. They use their larynx. You know, air goes through the larynx. It goes across the vocal folds. It creates frequencies and a buzzing vibration. And then it is then amplified in the vocal tract. Now, when that function no longer works, then the investment is gone. As opposed, you know, any new things, because the voice is completely shut. It's really hard to book a tour. And it's really hard to make new albums when the voice is given out. So I'm hoping in the future there will be an investment in the vocalist and the voice, and helping train it and helping, you know, looking at its effect over the next 10 years, as opposed to what can I learn and get from you right now? So I think having someone like me who has been an opera singer, who understands, you know, the science of singing and teaches in a way that promotes the use of this mechanism and understands the business affairs sides and is taking the time to humble my soul to be an opera singer, to be a music licensing person or music supervisor, to humble my soul to be an A&R person and learning that I think this shift, as far as I think I'm going to hopefully be, you know, lead the charge on this.
Yep. Well, good. It's awesome to see people like you out there breaking new ground in industries that have been around a long time and that have undergone a lot of shifts already. Yep. So, okay. Is it possible to sing without warming up? So if I were to ask you to just sing a few lines from an opera song, is that not possible unless you've warmed up? Because I don't want to put you on the spot.
Okay. Let's see. It is like 9 a.m. Let's see what happens. Let's see. What can I sing? Let me think. Okay, here we go. I'll just do that one. Yeah. Oh, it's pretty good for early in the morning.
Amazing. Well, Marcus, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a blast. Yeah. And Leadershifters, I hope that you really heard the resonance in some of the things that we talked about today, both in terms of finding your own thread of continuity in your unique journey, and that you don't have to have a PhD to be a lifelong learner. But even if you do, the humility of knowing that having a doctorate doesn't mean you know everything, that we're all learning and growing in this fast-paced, ever-changing world. And, you know, the other thing, I love the concept that you talked about today of waiting well. And it's a little bit of a tongue twister if you try and say it too quickly, which is part of waiting well. Yep. Saying it slowly. So what does that mean for you in whatever stage of life or business you're in right now? And LaMarcus is a complete example of what it looks like to wait well and launch into something new. So thank you for joining us. Leadershifters, as always, thank you for being here, and we will see you next time. Mwah.